Case number 20-5393, Carolyn Tipton versus Commissioner of Social Security. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Jones, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, Daniel Jones on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Carolyn Faye Tipton. This is an appeal of an agency decision from the Social Security Administration denying Ms. Tipton disability benefits. In this case, Ms. Tipton suffers from a combination of physical impairments, primarily rheumatological, including fibromyalgia and connective tissue disease, as well as arthritic conditions. These have been followed primarily by her treating board certified rheumatologist, Dr. Brackett, as well as by a group of pain management medical providers. Plaintiff's argument in this case centers on whether the administrative law judge properly determined Ms. Tipton's residual functional capacity, or RFC, which is basically the Social Security Administration's way of saying, what can Ms. Tipton do in an 8-hour workday on a consistent basis, five days a week or 40 hours a week? So Ms. Tipton has raised two arguments regarding this issue, one having to do with the opinions from the treating doctor, and one having to do with the with her testimony. But before I get to that, I just want to briefly talk about the standard of review here, because there's no dispute that this court is reviewing the agency decision for whether it's supported by substantial evidence or not. But I also want to point out that the other issue is whether there's also reversal is required when there's an error of law. Excuse me. And that is where most of the issues arise in this case. So this court has actually held that in the Rogers case that when there's an error of law, that itself denotes a lack of substantial evidence. And I think that's a sort of the Rogers case is a good place to start here, because the facts there are remarkably similar to those in Ms. Tipton's case. Both this case and in Rogers, the claimant suffered from fibromyalgia as well as another rheumatological disorder. In both cases, there was a treating rheumatologist who provided support for the claimant's disability. In both cases, the opinions from the rheumatologist were rejected based on opinions from a non-examining doctor. And in both cases, the ALJ placed undue weight on the claimant's activities of daily living to find the claimant's not disabled. And if anything, I think that the facts in this case are even more compelling than those in the Rogers case, because in that case, the ALJ relied on a number of non-examining doctors, including one who was a specialist and who actually testified at the claimant's hearing. Whereas in this case, the ALJ did not rely on the non-examining doctors. In fact, in a lot of ways, disagreed with those opinions because they reviewed such a limited portion of the record. And those, to the extent that the ALJ did rely on them, those opinions were based on a significantly undeveloped medical record. So turning specifically to what the ALJ found in this case, what she did was she said she was giving partial weight to the treating rheumatologist, Dr. Brackett. She said she agreed with Dr. Brackett's opinions on how much Ms. Tipton could lift and carry, but then rejected all of the other limitations described by the treating rheumatologist. In particular, how long Ms. Tipton can sit, stand, and walk, which are obviously critical. But also how often Ms. Tipton would require breaks from work during the day and how often she would miss work on a regular basis. The ALJ articulated two reasons for discounting those disabling limitations from Dr. Brackett. So the first finding made by the ALJ was that Dr. Brackett's disabling limitations are unsupported by, quote, grossly normal neurologic markers and unremarkable mental status examinations. Now, while that is true, plaintiff submits it's not relevant to the opinions from Dr. Brackett. Ms. Tipton hasn't been treated for any neurological conditions or mental conditions. Her impairments are rheumatological in nature in terms of the fibromyalgia and the connective tissue disease. Secondarily, she's also had a number of musculoskeletal impairments. So what I think this gets at is that the ALJ here was improperly substituting her lay opinion of what findings are relevant to the opinions from Dr. Brackett when there is no contradictory medical opinions on those issues that considered the same evidence. So to get to the point, Dr. Brackett specifically stated that his opinions were based on a number of abnormalities, including blood testing consistent with rheumatological and immunological conditions, including positive ANA tests, positive rheumatoid factor, elevated sedimentation rates, and also clinical abnormalities on examination, which included pain, inflammation, limited motion in multiple joints, reduced grip strength, tenderness, swelling, joint deformities, and trigger points consistent with those that are normally associated with fibromyalgia and are the main finding for diagnosing such a condition. As we noted in our brief, these findings are wholly consistent with both Dr. Brackett's treatment records, but also those from the pain management, who also noted similar findings and even at points more severe findings, including deconditioning to the point where she was having atrophy in her muscles. The second reason that the ALJ discounted the opinions from Dr. Brackett had to do with Ms. Tipton's activities. Now, this court has repeatedly held—
Counselor, let me ask you this. The record seems to say that the ALJ only gave partial weight to the treating physician opinion because of contrary evidence in the record pretty well demonstrated that she could do some form of work and that her residual functional capacity would permit her to do that. Now, do you have an opinion as to whether the ALJ was correct in that assessment? And if not, if you do, what would that be?
Sure. So in this case, we basically have an opinion from the treating specialist, and then the only other contrary opinion is the opinion from the non-examining state agency doctors. And the ALJ ultimately concludes that Ms. Tipton can perform sedentary work, but it's plaintiff's position that the ALJ hasn't cited to any specific evidence that outlines that specific residual functional capacity. Sedentary work would mean that she'd be sitting 6 hours a day and standing, walking the remaining 2 hours without having any unreasonable breaks or absences from work. Again, this is on a regular and sustained basis. So the ALJ in this case discounted both the opinions from the treating doctor and the opinions from the non-examining doctors on those limitations to the extent that they addressed them. In that case, we're left with only the clinical and objective findings here. Now, this court has repeatedly found that the ALJ can't interpret those medical findings into a particular residual function capacity. Now, there are decisions from the court that have held that an ALJ can certainly make common sense judgments about a residual functional capacity that based on a reading of the record when there's no evidence to the contrary. So the defendant does cite some cases that have held that the ALJ is free to determine an RFC without a specific medical opinion, but those cases are vastly different from this one where the plaintiff has put forth significant evidence from a treating specialist specifically delineating those limitations. There's no case that's held that an ALJ can interpret the evidence contrary to the opinions from a treating specialist on that regard. And I think that even in the normal case that this court has held that the opinions from non-examining doctors are generally entitled to less weight than treating specialists. But particularly under the facts of this case, it's significant when the treating doctor is a specialist, has cited evidence supporting his opinions. Those findings are consistent with the treatment records, both from him and from other sources. And the ALJ conceded that the non-examining doctors didn't have a good understanding of Ms. Tipton's residual functional capacity to the extent that that she found that actually Ms. Tipton would have greater limitations but then did not explain what evidence in the record supports those greater limitations. In addition, the non-examining doctors, as we pointed out, reviewed only a couple months of records here when we're dealing with a period of a few years at issue. And in addition to that, neither of the non-examining doctors are relevant specialists in the area of medicine. So I just also note quickly to finish my thought that the evidence, as we noted in our reply brief, shows that Ms. Tipton did significantly have exacerbations frequently in her conditions after the non-examining doctors reviewed it. That evidence was only considered by the treating specialist, not by any other physician. So unless there's any questions, I will reserve the rest of my time.
All right, we'll hear from Ms. Ziegler.
May it please the court. Ann Ziegler on behalf of the Social Security Administration. Mr. Jones, for plaintiff, frames this case as as showing error of law, but really he's not argued any error of law. He's only argued that the evidence, that substantial evidence doesn't support the decision, when actually in this case it does. And that is the significant, that is the standard of review that we need to keep in mind in this case. It's whether substantial evidence, substantial evidence supports the ALJ's decision. It's not whether there's enough evidence to support plaintiff's position, because in this case there could be, but it's the question is whether there's substantial evidence, that whether the ALJ discussed the evidence supporting his decision, and whether a reasonable fact finder, whether a reasonable mind could find that enough evidence supports that conclusion. And in this case, it does.
How would you distinguish Rogers from this case?
Rogers, Your Honor, honestly, I am not familiar with the facts of Rogers. I don't remember seeing that in the briefs, but if I did, I must have missed it. I'm not sure what the facts of that case were.
I believe that's the case he cited as establishing the error of law.
As error, yes, Your Honor. Well, that is true, that if there, that the court does look at whether, at both things, whether substantial evidence supports the decision or whether there is an error of law. I'm saying that counsel hasn't established an error of law. He hasn't argued that there's been an error of law. By the ALJ discounting a treating physician's opinion is not an error of law. The ALJ, that's the ALJ's job, is to evaluate the opinion evidence, the record as a whole, and establish an RFC. And doing so, finding an RFC for sedentary work in this case is not an error of law. With respect to Dr. Brackett's treating physician opinion, it is noteworthy that the ALJ didn't discount it completely. The ALJ did give it partial weight in assessing the RFC. And the ALJ articulated sufficient reasons for discounting the opinion, for not giving it controlling weight. And that is really the standard that's required. If the ALJ is not going to give a treating physician controlling weight, they have to give good reasons. And the ALJ here did just that, finding that other objective medical evidence in the record didn't support the limitations. Now, counsel argues that the ALJ is reweighing, substituting is her, it's her own opinion, but that's not really what happened in this case. The ALJ didn't interpret medical evidence as counsel suggests. The ALJ wasn't looking at lab reports and saying, well, this lab report doesn't show rheumatoid arthritis. That's not what the ALJ did here. The ALJ looked at that evidence and said, yes, it does. Dr. Brackett diagnosed rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia, I believe, as many of the impairments. And the ALJ found that those were severe impairments. But the ALJ looked at the opinion of functional limitations and found that the objective evidence didn't support the limitations, not that it didn't support the doctor's diagnosis. And that's where the difference, I think, here between what counsel is arguing is that it's the ALJ didn't look at the evidence like an MRI scan and interpret it differently than the doctor did. That's not what happened. Rather, the ALJ looked at the record as a whole, including other opinions, including the state agency opinions and plaintiff's own statements. It's significant to note that plaintiff herself testified that she spent most of her time sitting, that she could lift up to 10 pounds. Both of those are consistent with sedentary work. And the ALJ noted that in the decision, considered her statements, and found that that is consistent with sedentary work. Considered her own statements and considering the opinion evidence, Dr. Brackett's opinion that she could lift 5 to 10 pounds, the state agency opinions that found that she could do light work, when the ALJ, after considering all the evidence, even all that evidence that came in after the state agencies did their review, found that overall the evidence supported limitations not as severe as Dr. Brackett's, but more severe than the state agency. And so the ALJ found a middle ground there in between the opinions, considering her own testimony and other evidence, like her activities of daily living.
Due to a technical issue, this section of audio was not captured.
Those factors, as well as the objective evidence, the ALJ formulated the RFC based on the record as a whole.
Anything further?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. If Your Honors have no questions.
All right. Sure. Any rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, thank you. So I'd like to just address first what counsel said about that it's the ALJ's job to consider the entire record and determine the claimant's residual functional capacity. I don't think that's disputed. The residual functional capacity, though, still must be based on substantial evidence in the record. And here, particularly regarding how long Ms. Tipton can sit, stand, walk, how often she would require breaks, and how often she would miss work, that residual functional capacity is not supported by substantial evidence. It's actually not supported by any evidence. And although the ALJ can certainly consider evidence, and as counsel noted, the ALJ did not interpret the evidence to conclude that Ms. Tipton had some diagnosis different than the treating doctors, that's not the end of the analysis. And I particularly would direct the court to this court's decision in Shields. Now, in that case, also the ALJ discounted the opinions from a treating doctor and did not credit any contrary opinions. And while the court conceded that in some circumstances, the ALJ may be able to craft a residual functional capacity supported by substantial evidence that is not based on medical opinions, what the ALJ should not do is just list the diagnoses, say the diagnoses were considered along with the record as a whole, and then craft a residual functional capacity based on those diagnoses. And that is exactly what the ALJ did here, particularly with the opinions from the treating rheumatologist on how often Ms. Tipton would require breaks and be absent from work, because those opinions, frankly, are uncontradicted by anything in the record. But to the extent that the ALJ rejected the sit, stand, and walk opinions from Dr. Brackett, while they are contradicted by the opinions from the non-examining doctor, the ALJ felt that those opinions did not adequately capture the entire record. And in such circumstances, the ALJ certainly has many options available to her to develop the record. She could have called a medical expert to testify at the hearing, requested a consultative examination, but instead, she did not do any of those options, and instead we believe she improperly substituted her interpretation of the severity of Ms. Tipton's impairments, although not the diagnosis, and that is also improper.
That's what she really did. I thought what the ALJ purported to have done is to have given partial weight to the treating physician's opinion in light of contrary evidence in the record. Not that the ALJ disregarded the treating physician's opinion.
The ALJ stated that she agreed with Dr. Brockett's opinions and gave them great weight to the extent that the doctor described limitations lifting and carrying, but then continued on to discount every other opinion described by the treating doctor. So there's no dispute on how much Ms. Tipton can lift and carry. The crucial issue is, can she sit, stand, and walk long enough in a regular workday to complete that workday? And the treating rheumatologist said that she cannot, and cited to extensive evidence supporting those opinions, not just the diagnosis, but actually how limited Ms. Tipton would be. And the ALJ did not credit any evidence to the contrary on those. I would also note that counsel pointed out that Ms. Tipton stated that she spends a lot of her time sitting during the day and can lift up to 10 pounds. Again, how much she can lift and carry is not disputed. That's not an issue, and it's not alleged that that's disabling. But to the fact that she says she spends a lot of time sitting during the day, on page 361 of the record, she also said that she could sit for only 10 minutes at one time, then must get up and move around. And, that is not consistent with the sedentary job that the ALJ found, where she would be sitting most of the day, at least 6 hours at a time. So in conclusion, I believe that the opinions from the treating rheumatologist are supported by a voluminous record here. And the government's vocational expert has already testified that if those opinions were controlling or given significant weight, that Ms. Tipton would not be able to work. And I'd also note that Ms. Tipton is now receiving Social Security retirement benefits. So this is for a discrete period at issue. There wouldn't be any need to further develop the medical record on remand. And for that reason, I think that it's an appropriate case to reverse and to award Ms. Tipton benefits. But even if this court were to find that that is not appropriate in this case, certainly there's overwhelming evidence that the ALJ did not consider. And we're not asking this court to reweigh the evidence. We're asking that the ALJ properly weigh the evidence in the first instance. I see my time is up, but if you have any further questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you very much. And the case is submitted.